Good morning. It is wonderful to be back with you as we continue our walk together through the book of Genesis. You know, for several chapters now, we've been following the unfolding story of Jacob, who is the son of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham, through whom God chose to establish a covenant people for himself. And as we've seen, the problem has been that Abraham's family to this point has not been very covenant worthy. In fact, they've been a total mess. Jacob alone, whose name means deceiver, grasper, cheater, at the direction of his mother, pretended to be his brother Esau so he could steal the family blessing given by his aging father, Isaac. And from this, we read in chapter 27, beginning in verse 34, as soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." And Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he's taken away my blessing." In verse 41, now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him, and Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching, then I will kill my brother Jacob." And consequently, Jacob fled far away to his mother's homeland, where he lived for 20 years, being cheated by his twice father-in-law, Laban, until God called Jacob to return to Canaan, the promised land of his ancestors. So this family, this chosen by God family, was one of complete discord, disrepute, and disunity. Yet this is the family that God chose, and this is the family God would use to display his faithfulness in bringing about his covenant people in his promised place under his own provision and protection, all for the sake of the glorious gospel proclamation of who he is. God would be glorified through this seemingly irredeemable family. Now, as he's returning to Canaan after 20 years, Jacob knows he is returning not only to his homeland, but to the shadows of his broken and deceptive past. The man he has been must come face to face with the man he is being called to be. And in no way is this more personified than in the fact that Jacob must now face his brother Esau, who we read 2 weeks ago was approaching Jacob with 400 men. And Jacob had sent all that he had, his flocks, his herds, his servants, ahead of him, hoping to appease Esau before they met, or perhaps get some indication of Esau's intention. But still, the sense of the unknown was a great weight upon Jacob. What would Esau do? For that matter, what would Jacob do? And above all, what would God do? So let's read Genesis 32, beginning in verse 22. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Then he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. And the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. Now, this is a somewhat well-known biblical account. It made it into a U2 song. But though well-known, it is certainly still a mysterious passage. After an initial reading, we may be left with more questions than answers. Now, who was the man? Why did they wrestle? Why couldn't or wouldn't the mysterious man win? What's with the exchange of names? And why did Jacob leave this altercation broken, limping, and hobbling away, yet seemingly at peace? Well, though this is a seemingly strange passage to us on many levels, if you're like me, Jacob's struggle here, particularly as it relates to God, seems somewhat familiar, even personal. Perhaps we too, in our own way, have wrestled with God in a season of doubt and fear. Because this event occurred at a significant point of crisis in Jacob's life. Jacob knew what he had done. He knew who he was. He knew what he deserved. Jacob knew that in a matter of hours, he would face a terrible and frightening unknown. This would be a very dark and lonely night before a difficult and potentially devastating dawn. And so we read in verse 22. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, that could be translated as sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. Now, why did Jacob send his family to the other side of the Jabbok as Esau approached while he himself stayed on the other side? Well, we aren't explicitly told, but I think there are probably three plausible scenarios. One, Jacob may have been hoping that Esau and his army would be sympathetic to Jacob if they met his family first. Maybe the sight of nephews and a niece and sisters-in-law would soften Esau's heart. A second, Jacob may just have been a big fat coward. If Esau attacked Jacob's family, Jacob would see and have time to escape before Esau could ford the river. Jacob may be trying to use his family as a cushion between himself and his brother, like a jerk. But third, what I think is most likely is that Jacob may simply have wanted and needed to be alone. Alone with himself, his thoughts, his fears, and his prayers. Now, whatever the reason, as Jacob seeks isolation to wrestle with himself and his circumstances and his thoughts, he has no idea what kind of struggle this night is going to bring. Verse 24 continues, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Now, who was the man? Why did he wrestle Jacob? Well, we might expect to read that it was Esau, having mounted a surprise attack against his defenseless brother by night. We might expect it to be Laban, having tracked down Jacob and finding him in a moment of weakness to get revenge and retake his spoil. We might even expect it to be some unknown robber seeking to take advantage of this lone man who is obviously preoccupied in the dark. All we are told here, however, is that it was a man. This was a physical, flesh and blood encounter. Later, however, as Jacob identifies in verse 30, this man was God. Now, at what point in the encounter did Jacob realize his opponent was God in human flesh? Well, we aren't told. We simply learn that Jacob knew his assailant was indeed God himself. Now, Hosea chapter 12, verse 4 actually goes further, telling us that Jacob wrestled an angel. Now, the word angel simply means one who delivers a message from or for God. Now, does that mean that Jacob was mistaken about the man being God and that it was, in fact, just an angel? Well, not necessarily. These three terms biblically do coexist at times. We've seen this in Genesis chapter 16, Genesis 22, even in Exodus 3. As God appears in a physical form, but is described as an angel or a messenger. Now, many scholars say that when God appears in a physical form to deliver a message or interact with mankind, it is a physical manifestation of God the Son, the Word, the second person of the Trinity, that this is part of his role and function within the Godhead. Now, if this is the case, then in essence, Jacob would have been wrestling the pre-incarnate Jesus, God the Son in human form. Now, personally, I lean this direction, but you can debate it over lunch at Chili's. But regardless, we should not be surprised that in this moment of Jacob's anguish and his agony, the man decides to wrestle him. Because Jacob, both by name and practice, had been a constant wrestler. Jacob had been trying to get the upper hand over others his entire life, to wrestle, to manipulate them and their circumstances for his own gain. Jacob had relationally wrestled with Esau, his brother. Jacob had deceptively wrestled with Isaac, his father. Jacob had selfishly wrestled away his family's blessing and status. Jacob had emotionally wrestled with Laban, his father-in-law. Jacob's entire life had been marked by struggle and wrestling with man. But now Jacob found himself struggling against one much greater. Verse 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. So while this is a struggle that Jacob realizes he cannot win, it is one he is determined not to lose. Now, why couldn't or wouldn't God prevail against Jacob? Was Jacob too strong? Was God too weak? Well, neither. We see that when God decides to do so, he knocks Jacob's hip out of socket with a single touch. Now, this word touch in the Hebrew can mean anything from a simple tap to a devastating strike. It's simply a form of contact. But what is significant, however, is not the type of touch from God, but its timing. At any time, God could have injured Jacob's hip beyond repair. He could have struck Jacob with a lightning bolt or ceased to give him breath in his lungs, dropping Jacob dead with just a thought. The goal of God's injury to Jacob, however, was not for God's benefit, so that he could beat Jacob in a fight. It was for Jacob's benefit. Jacob needed to lose at something he wanted so desperately to control. Yet he needed to know that even if he lost, he could still prevail. And why? Because in the end, Jacob's failures or successes or strivings weren't what made him what he was. It was God's sovereign work and sovereign word in Jacob's life that defined him. So verse 26. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." So God decides to end this wrestling match as day breaks, which is not what Jacob wants to see or hear. Jacob has been ruining the arrival of this day for some time. He had strategized and agonized and tried to position himself against what this day might bring. Yet as it always does, the sunrise eventually broke, and Jacob would have to face that which he could not manipulate or control. Jacob's wrestling was done. He must face by the light of day that which he feared in the night. And now Jacob's response to this is, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." You know, this is somewhat comical. Jacob is just clinging to God with one leg out of joint, flailing around. He imposes no physical threat to God. He's like the Black Knight in Monty Python. "'Tis but a scratch." But still, as the emerging light begins to dawn on the combatants, Jacob, as we have seen him do before, grasps to receive a blessing that he has not earned. Now, what's ironic in this statement is that God had not only already blessed Jacob numerous times, but he had been blessing Jacob his entire life. Before Jacob was even born, his mother Rebekah received a revelation of God's intent to bless Jacob, the younger son, in chapter 25, verse 23. As Jacob fled Canaan, God renewed his covenant blessing to him back in chapter 28, verse 15. God said, "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go." Even in the midst of Jacob's back and forth with Laban, the Lord again reiterated his promised blessing to Jacob in chapter 31, 11 through 13. God had blessed Jacob, was blessing Jacob, and had promised to continue blessing Jacob. Now, what more did Jacob want? Well, though Jacob knew God had already spoken his words of promise, what Jacob wanted was assurance from God in this moment. Jacob knew that God had covenantally set him apart by his grace. Jacob knew God was with him and would be wherever he went. But what about here? What about now? And Jacob believed God in theory, but could he trust God with this outcome, which was growing closer with every inch of morning light? "No, I will not go until you bless me now," Jacob said. "Promise me I won't get hurt. Tell me this will turn out all right. Promise me your covenant provision and your protection still applies in this." Rather than reassuring Jacob, however, God asks him a simple question. What is your name? Who are you? Now, did God not know Jacob's name? Well, of course he did. But he wanted Jacob to say it. So this time, to disclose one's name meant more than just providing a title. It was a form of self-disclosure. Names carry great significance regarding a person's character, their history, even their future. Thus, for Jacob, whose name appropriately meant deceiver and thief, to tell God his name would be to make a confession, both of who he was and who he had been. God wanted Jacob to confess, to admit, to come to terms with his identity. And so Jacob tells God his name. He confesses, "Yes, God, as you know, I'm Jacob. I'm a cheat, all right? I'm a deceiver. I'm a manipulator. I've done terrible things for personal gain. Is that what you want to hear?" In this moment, however, rather than shaming Jacob for his name and his identity, God gives him a completely new one. He says, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel." Now, Israel is a combination of two Hebrew words, sarah, meaning contend or wrestle or persist, and El, meaning God. And some translate it in that order, wrestles God, or one who wrestles with God. Now, the most accurate translation, I think, puts God as the subject, not the object, meaning God contends, God wrestles, God persists. But either way, God's renaming of Jacob is not only a sign of God's authority over him, but it is a gift of revelation to what truly has been the struggle marking Jacob his entire life all along. Because Jacob saw himself as struggling against man all his life. Yet in reality, his struggle had always been much deeper. Jacob, the wrestler of man and circumstances, in reality, had always been Israel. He had always been wrestling with God. And though in light of Esau's impending arrival, Jacob considered himself to be in the eye of the storm, though he feared prospective loss of possessions, even his own life, though he was trying to figure out how he could get himself out of the situation and make himself prevail, God reminds Jacob who is truly in the arena. God wrestles. The battle, as it always does, belongs to the Lord. At the center of Jacob's new name is not Jacob, his history, his ability, his character. At the center of Jacob's new name is God, his history, his ability, his character. Jacob wrestles, grasps, and manipulates, but in the end, he only wrestles with God. He only grasps at God. He tries to manipulate God. All the while, the one truly in the fight, the one prevailing, is not Jacob, it's the God of Jacob. God wrestles, and Jacob, Israel, wrestles with God. But still, Jacob is somewhat uncertain. Verse 29, "Then Jacob asked him, 'Please tell me your name.' But he said, 'Why is it that you ask my name? and there he blessed him. Now, why does Jacob ask God's name? Well, Jacob wants assurance. He wants a handle, some place to set his foot on God's promise and his character. He wants something new, a greater insight, a greater revelation from God, so he can know that he can trust God now. Jacob wants something more. But God doesn't give Jacob something more. In response, God simply says, "Why is it that you ask my name?" In essence, he says, "You know who I am. You know who I've been. You know who I will be." Jacob has been a man who has stumbled his entire life, yet God has been faithfully with him at every step. Jacob knew everything he needed to know about God. He simply had to trust and surrender to him now. And so he did. And so again, God blessed him. So the issue wasn't that God wouldn't bless Jacob. He would, he did, and he had. What Jacob needed was not another blessing, but just to remember who God is. God was God. Jacob didn't need God to become more God for this situation to work out. Jacob simply needed to remember who was truly in the battle all along. Now, verse 30. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." This word Peniel or Penuel means face of God. So what Jacob takes from this encounter is not a sense of dread. It's not a sense that God abandoned him or was unfair to wrestle with him. No, the sum of this encounter for Jacob is the fact that he saw God and he lived. Jacob recognizes both God's mercy and his own unworthiness of it. Thus, it is not the twisted, agonizing face of Jacob that defines this encounter, nor is it the impending stony face of Esau on the horizon. It's the wonderful, merciful face of God that defines this place and this time for Jacob. Verse 31. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. So what do we see from Jacob here in verse 31? Well, this one who the night before had been shrinking in retreat after this altercation with God, though limping, is now moving boldly, even peacefully, forward. As the morning Jacob dreaded dawns, Jacob does not try to escape to the hills, leaving his family defenseless. He does not stay in Peniel, seeking more time and more assurance from God. Now, having been with God face to face, Jacob learned the lesson, and now he passes on. Yet as Israel now moved forward from this day and for the rest of his life, he would do so with a limp, both proof and a reminder that God had been with him and that it was God's strength that would prevail. However this day unfolded, Jacob saw that he did not have to or need to manipulate it. He simply needed to rest in God's sovereignty over it. Now, church, a question. Have you ever wrestled with God? I mean, while you've never physically wrestled God in human form, my guess is that at one time or another, if you're like me, you have spent one or many lonely, dark nights of the soul struggling with God. You've looked at whatever is before you and realized you can't work it. You can't manipulate it. You can brace yourself for the battle, but you cannot escape the war. And in the midst of that night, in the midst of that darkness, where is God? Well, he is right there wrestling with you. Now, like Jacob, you too may have asked for assurance from God, even pleaded for an answer or a blessing, some kind of surety that at daybreak everything would be okay. Yet, like Jacob, what you may have received was simply a reminder to be still and know that he is God. He is who he is. We cannot try to change him. We can only choose to trust him. Now, we may have to face the difficult consequences of our past. We may have to face the effects of a broken and sin-soaked world inside of us and around us. We may have to face seemingly insurmountable obstacles on the path that God has set before us. Yet when we do, we can know that we do not do so alone. Now, God's people are Israel. God wrestles, even when we wrestle with God. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your word, which is truth. We thank you that you show us both who we are and who you are. That we, in and of ourselves, and our own identity, are people who want to sit on the throne, who want to manipulate and change people and circumstances for our own pleasure, our own delight, that our own will and way may prevail. But God, we are broken, we are sinful, and so is our way. But God, I thank you for this example here. Rather than shaming Jacob for his name, you gave him a new one. And God, we know and celebrate the fact that you have done the same for us. Because of the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross, we can know our sin has been atoned for, our debt has been paid, and because Christ is raised, so too we are raised to walk in a newness of life, trusting and following you as your children. And I thank you for this truth. I pray for each and every person as they have heard your word, God, that they would know too, that they can trust you, that they can follow you. To whatever this world has to offer, God, you are stronger, you are greater. And all we have to do is rest in the finished work of Christ, to let you be God and to surrender to your will and your way. We thank you that you're good. We thank you that we can gather together to celebrate you. It's in the strong, beautiful name of Jesus, our Christ, that I pray. Amen.